Hello, Ken, and hello, everyone. Here with you, if anyone remembers, but 2 weeks ago I said I wouldn't be here tonight. That's because we thought we'd be closing on the retreat house on Monday, and tonight we were scheduled to go shop with the owner to buy a chair. But of course, because of the hellstorm, we have not closed on the retreat house, and so I don't need to go shopping, and so here I am. Arguing the same message in I Am That that we started last time, which is message number 13. It's called The Supreme, the Mind, and the Body. And if you happen to have the book and you're reading along, I'm starting on page 34, about three quarters or two thirds, maybe probably closer to two thirds of the way down. And I'm just going to jump right in. So the questioner says, there is the consciousness, and there is the witnessing consciousness. Is the second supreme? So basically, he's saying that which we see and its consciousness, and then there's that which sees and its consciousness. So there's two kinds, two consciousness. I don't know if he's saying there's two consciousness divided into subject and object. And he's basically asking, is the subject supreme? So I'll read the question for you again. There is the witnessed consciousness, and there is the witnessing consciousness. The second, the supreme. The Sargadatta Maharaj says, there are the two, the person and the witness, the observer. When you see them as one and go beyond, you are in the supreme state. It is not perceivable because it's perception possible. It is beyond being and non-being. It is neither the mirror nor the image in the mirror. It is what is the timeless reality, unbelievably hard and solid. And I remember him using these words, I think last time is too, hard and solid, which I think are very interesting words for describing the formless. But when he says that it's neither the mirror nor the image in the mirror, he's really saying that the supreme is neither consciousness, consciousness would be the mirror, nor is it the image in the mirror, manifestation. He says it is what makes both of them possible. So he's pointing to what we call the first principle of God, life awareness. If you were in gentle healing last night in gentle healing, Ramana Maharshi, there was a Ramana Maharshi quote that said, anything that is not in deep sleep is, and we had a sharing from Rupert Spira, which really talked about deep sleep being nothing but peace, absolute peace, which would mean absolute peace is all that is real and everything else isn't. And so this is the same thing that Nisargadatta Maharaj is pointing to. So he starts by saying there are the two, the person and the witness or the observer. So I can observe what appears to be me, Regina. Right? I can observe Regina. And so some might say that there's I, the observer, and Regina, the observed or the object. But then Nisargadatta says, when you see them as one and go beyond, you are in the supreme state. So when you see them as one, that's what I often call unity consciousness. In unity consciousness, there is no division. The way people often describe the experience of unity consciousness is by saying things like, all there is consciousness. There's no more left. So I would no longer say, for example, there is Regina, and then there is the observer, which observes Regina, right? It's all consciousness. Come to this, he says, is seeing both the subject and object as one. And then you go beyond that, which would be returning to the first principle of God. That's when you're in the supreme state. When you see them as one and go beyond, you are in the supreme state. It, the supreme state, right? It is not perceivable. And if we look back at the Ramana Maharshi quote last night, when he referred to the only things that are real are in deep sleep, right? He said everything that is not in deep sleep is not real. But we all know that deep sleep is not perceivable, right? We don't have perceptions from deep sleep. Dreaming sleep, yes, but not from deep dreamless sleep. There are no perceptions there. And so he is saying that reality is not perceivable. It is not perceivable because it is what makes perception possible. It is beyond being and non-being. It is neither the mirror, so it's not consciousness, nor the image in the mirror, so it's not manifestation. It is what is, a timeless reality. And then I wish he was here so I could ask him why he uses these words, unbelievably hard and solid. And maybe in order to fully understand why he is using these words, hard and solid, to describe, life awareness, the first principle of God, maybe we just have to wake up to that ourselves. Maybe when we wake up to hard, I'm sorry, when we wake up to the first principle of God, then we understand why he would refer to it as hard and solid. One of the definitions of hard, I don't know if he's referring to this definition, but one of the definitions of hard is reliable, especially because it's based on something true or substantiated. So maybe, after awakening to the first principle of God, everything prior to the first principle of God, although form seems hard and so less now, it could be that after awakening to that level, form actually seems flimsy or even transparent, and that what seems hard and solid is the reality, right? Listen to this definition of hard again. Reliable, especially because based on something true or substantiated, right? So even though it's formless, it's hard and solid. It's the reality. It's based on something true and substantiated, where everything else isn't, right? So maybe that's why he uses the words hard and solid. Yeah, and another and a definition of solid, there's also a definition of solid which says dependable or reliable. So again, he's not necessarily saying that it's hard in the way a tool is hard. That it's real, that it's reliable, that it's the truth. The questioner says, the Yanani, which of course would be the enlightened one, the Yanani, is he the witness or the supreme? And Nisargadatta says, he is the supreme, of course. But he can also be viewed as the universal witness. And of course, we talked about this last night as well, I believe, that, the mistake is believing that we are merely manifestation, merely the person. And it is more true to say that we are the creative principle. And that's a very helpful realization. But it's even more true to say that we are consciousness, the second level, the second principle of God. But truth is to say we are life awareness, the first principle of God. But of course, if we are life awareness and everything else comes from life awareness, then we have to also be everything, right? Can't be the first principle of God without also being everything. So it makes sense that Nisargadatta would say that the enlightened one is the supreme and also the universal witness, where the question is he the witness or the supreme? And the answer is, well, both, right? And again, if you really contemplate this, this makes perfect sense because to be both or to be all is not separation. You know, our mind wants to divide it into pieces, and you're either going to be the first principle of God or the second principle of God or the third principle of God or the fourth principle of God, right? But there's separation in that. It's the truth is you're all of it. But your realization of what you are is highest and most true when you realize yourself as the first principle of God and therefore everything. Right? So the question is the Yanani, is he the witness or the supreme? And Nisargadatta says he is the supreme, of course. But he can also be viewed as the universal witness. And the questioner says, but he remains a person? And Nisargadatta says, when you believe yourself to be a person, you see persons everywhere. In reality, there are no persons, only threads of memories and habits. At the moment of realization, the person ceases. Identity remains, but identity is not a person. It is inherent in the reality itself. The person has no being in itself. It is a reflection in the mind of the witness. The I, which again, is a mode of being. So here again, he's saying even the I am is not real, right? Because he's looking at the first principle of God, the highest truth, as the only truth. When he talks about persons as being threads of memories and habits, he's really the same thing that I point to when I describe everything in manifestation, including person, as being made through the creative principle, right? As we, appearing as people, give attention to thoughts, emotions, and perceptions, everything else in manifestation is made from what we gave our attention to, including what appears to be the people, right? So the people are not real. They are in effect, they're wisps. Wisps. I say wisps because to me, like a wisp is something that appears very briefly. And a person is a wisp. It appears very briefly. Through the creative principle. The reason the person seems to last longer than briefly is because we, in our memories, with our brains, with our minds, take all of those wisps and we link them together in our mind and we say that, 58 years is one person. That's Regina. She's 58 years old. You know, we take a series of very momentary wisps and we link them together and we call it a person. If we didn't have brains, human brains, we would not be able to do that. I'm 50 now. Yeah, I had a birthday on August 2nd. I was born in 1960, and this is 2018. I like the fact that I was born in 1960 because it makes the math easy. So when I forget how old I am, I just have to look at what year it is. I think that's pretty but I'm wondering if you all understand the wisp that I'm talking about. One of the classes that we teach in the MPP program is Introduction to Kabbalah or Kabbalah. And one of the teachers that's quoted in that is a Dr. David. I think his name might be Godman, but I might have his last name wrong right now. But I remember his first name is David. And the reason I remember his first name is David is because he uses that as an example. He says that he is not, is it Goldman? Oh, thank you, Dr. David Goldman, I'm told. So he says that it's not that I'm David. I'm David Ean. And I'll write that out for anyone who's like, what? David Ean, right? David ING. Because I am not something solid. I am a process that is constantly in creation, which he also refers to as creationing. What appears as me and what appears as you in this moment in time is what I'm referring to as a wisp. And then there appears to be another wisp and another wisp, and we link them together and we call them a person. But what appears as the person right now is only for right now. It's what's made right now from the creative principle. And in the next moment, regardless of how it appears, it's actually an entirely different creation. Yes, Eileen, like a frame in a movie. That's what I'm referring to as a wisp. Like a frame in a movie. Thank you. That's probably a much better example. And then we link them all together and we think we have something solid and real and constant. So Nisargadatta is saying when you believe yourself to be a person rather than a process, that's the word. Rather than the person being a process. When you believe yourself to be a person, you see persons everywhere, right? So if I believe that I'm a collection of 58 years of these frames and that all of them together make up what I am, well, then that's also what I think about you, right? I think you're your entire, what we would call your entire history. When you believe yourself to be a person, you see persons everywhere. In reality, there are no persons, only threads of memories and habits. At the moment, the person ceases, right? When you see what you are, you no longer identify with these names as you. You no longer identify with these wisps, with these momentary creations, with this string of momentary creations as you. At the moment of realization, the person ceases. Now he says identity remains. In other words, knowing what you are. Still knowing what you are, identity. So that remains. You don't lose knowing what you are. Identity remains, but identity is not a person. Is inherent in the reality. The person has no being in itself. And you can at least understand what that means if you realize that the person is a string of frames or a string of wisps or a string of momentary creations. Right? It has no being. It is a reflection in the mind of the witness. Because it is a consciousness, the second principle of God, witnessing, giving attention to, thought and perception, that creates the next momentary creation or wisp. So the person has no being in itself. It is a reflection in the mind of the witness, the I am. And then notice he says, which again is a mode of being. So he says, I am is not the supreme. Even consciousness is not reality. The second principle of God is not the first principle of God, right? Now the questioner says, is the supreme conscious? And Nisargadatta says, it is neither conscious nor unconscious. I'm telling you from experience. It's neither conscious nor unconscious. You know, that's something that the mind cannot grasp. You know, again, I think the best example that we have is deep sleep. Deep sleep is not what we would call conscious, right? In fact, most people would call it to be unconscious, sleeping like that. You're unconscious, but it isn't unconscious either. Yeah, I'm not sure how my sound is going to be. I'm on a hot spot. My internet went out. Can you guys let me know if the sound is good? Oh, it is good. Yay. Woohoo. Well, then I'll just take a drink and continue. Yeah, for some reason our internet just dropped. I sound better on my hot spot? Oh, wow. Okay. So we were looking at the fact that what he calls the supreme, what I call the first principle of God, is neither conscious or unconscious. You can't label it as either. Now I'm going to move on to the next question. He starts, the questioner says, Prajnam Brahma. What is Prajna? So Prajnanam Brahma. What is Prajna? And Nisargadatta says, it is the unself-conscious knowledge of life itself. I'm going to highlight that. I love that sentence. I think it's the first time since teaching from I Am That that I've pulled out the highlighter. But I'm highlighting that sentence right there. It is the unself-conscious knowledge of life itself. Bernadette Roberts wrote two entire books on that, on this one sentence. She probably never read this sentence. She was just talking from her own experience. But it's unself-conscious, right? I wrote that in there so you can see that, unself-conscious. So, in order to understand what unself-conscious is, first let's look at ourselves. What happens for each of us is that we are conscious of ourself. My phone is now on low battery, so we'll see what happens with the hotspot. We are conscious of ourself. Some of us may be more so, and some of us may be less so, but we are aware of what we call me. What Bernadette Roberts talks about when she talks about awakening to what I call the first principle of God is that the mechanism, whatever that mechanism is, it's never really described what that is, but whatever that mechanism is that allows us to be aware of ourself, it ends. It dies. It ceases to be. And when that mechanism that allows us to be aware of ourself ceases to be, we become aware of the supreme or the first principle of God. And again, Bernadette Roberts wrote two entire books on this, and someday I might go through those books with you because they're really quite good. Yeah, I think yeah, Jacqueline is saying Amodah Maw talked about letting go of self-referencing. I think self-referencing is a stage just before unselfconscious, I think. I think self-referencing is looking at everything through the filter of me. And when you get to unity consciousness, I think you are no longer looking at everything through the filter of me, but there's still an awareness of me or I am. And at the first principle of God, there is no longer an awareness of I am. That mechanism, she calls it a mechanism, that mechanism that allows you to be conscious of a self, whether it's a person or whether it's consciousness itself, ends. And so this is what Nisargadatta is referring to. He says it is the unself-conscious knowledge of life itself. The unself-conscious knowledge of life itself. And this is what I believe Michael Langford means by the final end of the ego. You know, ego is just a word, and ego can be defined in many different ways. But the primary definition of ego that is used by most of the teachers that I have contemplated is a sense of self. Not the wrong mind. Some people think of ego as the wrong mind, right? But even after the wrong mind ends, there's still a sense of self. It may be a sense of self as I am consciousness. It may be purely right-minded with no wrong mind remaining. But it's still a sense of self. When the sense of self ends completely, that is awakening to the first principle of God, or what Michael Langford calls the final end of the ego. Let me read what Cheryl has written here. The first principle of God, it ends. I am interested. Tell me more. I'm interested in reading this. I've been asking for something to read. This is it. Okay. Well, the first principle of God does not end. I don't know if that's what you mean when you say it ends. The first principle of God is the one eternal. Yeah. But if you want to read about this, there are two books. Oh, you were quoting. Okay. There are two books that I would recommend. And I recommend reading the two together, maybe even kind of going back and forth. One of the books is a story, and it's called The Experience of No Self. The other book is more like a textbook, I gotta tell you. It's written more like a textbook, and it's called What is the Self? And they are both by Bernadette Roberts. And I really do recommend reading them together. I feel like each book casts light upon the other. And if you read either book by itself, you know, it's kind of like you're missing part of what you need in order to fully understand what's happening. But again, that's what this one sentence is about. It is the unself-conscious knowledge of life itself. That's what Bernadette Roberts' two books are pointing to. Now the questioner says, is it vitality, the energy of life, livingness. And Nisargadatta says, energy comes first, for everything is a form of energy. Consciousness is most differentiated in the waking state, less so in dreaming, still less in sleep, homogeneous in the fourth state. Beyond, beyond, beyond is the inexpressible, monolithic reality, the abode of the Anani. So in effect, what he's telling this man is, everything you know is not it. Everything you know is not it. You know, you're trying to place it with something that you know. You know, like we might get very, very still. When I get very, very still, I hear a ringing in my ears. You know, so if I was this man, I might say, the ringing in my ears, is that it? And the answer is no, because you know that. The ringing in your ears is an object that you are aware of. Therefore, that's not it. So I might go back and close my eyes again, and I might notice just all of these tingles in the body. And I might say, the tingles in the body, is that it? No. No, because you are aware of the tingles in the body. You know, they're an object that you are aware of. So the tingles in the body cannot be it. And I close my eyes again and I notice just a feeling of aliveness in the body. Maybe that's what he means by energy. Just this feeling of aliveness. I say, the feeling of aliveness, is that it? No, because you are aware of the feeling of aliveness. Right? There's nothing that we can know in a subject-object type of way that is the absolute. And so that's what he's telling this man. He's saying, you know, energy comes first, because the man says, is it the energy? He says, energy comes first, for everything is a form of energy. So he's referring to manifestation here. Consciousness is most differentiated in the waking state, less so in dreaming, still less in sleep, right? So your subject-object consciousness, you're most aware of that in what we call the waking state, a little less aware of it, but it's still there in the dreaming state, even less in deep sleep, right? You're not aware of it at all. I'm not sure what the fourth state is. He says homogeneous is in the fourth state. But then he says, beyond, beyond is the inexpressible, monolithic reality, the abode of the Anani. It's beyond anything you can know. Again, Michael Langford points to this when he says, nearly all of the words in the dictionary, you know, point to illusion, point to non-truth. Anything you can know is not it. In a subject-object type of way, right? The questioner says, I have cut my hand, it healed. By what power did it heal? Nisargadatta says, by the power of life. The questioner says, what is that power? And Nisargadatta says, it is consciousness. All is conscious. And the questioner says, what is the source of consciousness? And Nisargadatta says, consciousness itself is the source of everything. And here, I don't know for sure, because it's difficult to tell, if he is using consciousness differently, because some people do use the word consciousness to refer to the first principle of God. Remember, all of these words are just words and they get used differently. I call it life awareness, but he could call it consciousness, right? So I can't tell right now, maybe as we read further we'll be able to tell. I can't tell if he's using consciousness to refer to the first principle, or when he says it's the source of everything, if by everything he means manifestation. So I don't have enough in this short sentence to know for sure what he's saying here. The questioner says, what is the source of consciousness? And he answers, consciousness itself is the source of everything. And the questioner says, can there be life without consciousness? And Nisargadatta says, no, nor consciousness without life. They are both one. So maybe he is referring to consciousness as the first principle of God, where I call it life awareness. Maybe he would call it life consciousness, right? Can there be life without consciousness? No, nor consciousness without life. They're both one. And then he says, but in reality, only the ultimate is. Right? So maybe he's not calling consciousness the first principle of God. You know, it's kind of hard when you're looking at words sometimes because he uses the word but in reality, only the ultimate is. So I would say with this sentence, you know, he's really saying the second principle of God, the third principle of God, the fourth principle of God are all very, very related. You know, everything in the fourth principle of God, everything in manifestation is consciousness, right? I mean, they're the same thing. And so, you know, he's really kind of, it sounds like he's talking in circles, but he's really saying, you know, all of that is the same. And then he says, but in reality, only the ultimate is. So again, maybe he's pointing beyond, 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 beyond. There's the truth. Yeah, I think he is saying that. Listen to what he says next. Again, the question was, can there be life without consciousness? And the answer is no, nor consciousness without life. They are both one. But in reality, only the ultimate is. The rest is a matter of name and form. And as long as you cling to the idea that only what has name and shape exists, the supreme will appear to you as non-existent. When you understand that names and shapes are hollow shells without any content whatsoever, and that what is real is nameless and formless, pure energy of life and light of consciousness, you will be at peace, immersed in the deep silence of reality. So, I don't want to pick apart these words anymore. I just don't. I don't want to pick apart the words and say, what does he mean by consciousness? Or what does he mean? I don't want to do that. I want to. You know, there's a teaching in NTI Revelation that talks about the fact that the mind, you know, the mind tries to understand through understanding the parts. And then in order to have true understanding, you have to look at the whole and not the parts. And I feel like that's what we have to do with this paragraph. I feel like if we look at this paragraph and really try and figure out, for example, what he means by the word consciousness, which is where I started, that we're going to miss the whole and therefore miss what he's saying. So I want to forget about the words. I want to read the entire paragraph and I want to feel what he's saying beyond those words, whatever words he chooses to use. So I'm going to read the entire paragraph without stopping to comment. And then I'm going to put the meaning that I get from the paragraph in my own words and forget all about his. So here we go. Can there be life without consciousness? The answer is no. Nor consciousness without life. They are both one. But in reality, only the ultimate is. The rest is a matter of name and form. And as long as you cling to the idea that only what has name and shape exists, the supreme will appear to you as non-existent. When you understand that names and shapes are hollow shells without any content whatsoever, and that what is real is nameless and formless, pure energy of life and light of consciousness. You will be at peace, immersed in the deep silence of reality. So if I put that in my own words, then what I would say is that, again, as long as you think that what you perceive has importance, then you're going to be like the house that the foolish man built on sand, right? And when the storms come, you know, you're going to be shifted around in the storms, blown to and fro. When you realize in a very deep and genuine way that you are the unaffected, then you are like the house that the wise man built on a foundation of rock. And when the storm comes, you are at peace. So, the unaffected is what is real. The unaffected is what is hard and solid, to use his words before, which might be reliable and true. The person and all of the different situations that the person lives through, they are the wisps. They are the frames. They are momentary, and then they're gone. Therefore, as he says in this particular paragraph, they are hollow shells without any content whatsoever. So the form is the hollow shell. The unaffectedness is what's hard and solid. I'm getting a million texts from Danielle because she saw a big spider. So I'm getting all these texts about the spider. I'll read them later. But I can see them coming across, the text come across my computer screen too. So it's kind of funny. Okay, so the next question is, you love spiders? I don't think Danielle does. The next question is, if time and space are mere illusions and you are beyond, please tell me. Oh my God. Oh my God. Sometimes questioners, you know, that sometimes questioners are really just a bundle of resistance. And you know, Ramana Maharshi used to not answer these types of questions. And I used to think a long time ago when I would read, I would think he should at least, you know, give them an answer. And now I'm like, oh, I'm so glad he didn't answer. Like now I think I probably wouldn't answer either. I'd probably just look at someone and move on. Are you ready for this question? Okay, listen to this. If time and space are mere illusions and you are beyond, please tell me, what is the weather in New York? Is it hot or raining there? So, I don't know what to say to that. We'll find out what Nisargadatta says. But the question itself implies, obviously, a complete lack of understanding on the part of the questioner, and resistance, frustration, disbelief, and attack. Right. So, but Nisargadatta does answer. I see a whole paragraph here. So let's see how he answers. He says, how can I tell you? Such things need special training, or one can just travel to New York. I may be quite certain that I am beyond time and space, and yet unable to locate myself at will at some point of time and space. I'm not interested enough. I see no purpose in undergoing a special yogic training. I have just heard of New York. To me, it is a word. Why should I know more than the word conveys? Every atom may be a universe as complex as ours. Must I know them all? I can, if I train. You know, and it's certainly in India, I've heard, you know, I don't have any direct experience of this, but I've certainly heard that there are yogis that can train themselves to manifest all kinds of things and know all kinds of things. But you know, one of the things I loved about Ramana Maharshi when I first read a book about him was that he thought that all of those kinds of special powers were completely meaningless. And in fact, I will tell you, the first time I came across Ramana Maharshi's teaching, now this was after Inner Ramana. In fact, it was because of Inner Ramana that I came across Ramana Maharshi's teachings. You know, as I was receiving Inner Ramana, I was posting it daily. I think at that time we were still on the Peace of God Yahoo group. It was before Facebook. And I was posting daily what I was receiving. And there were people out there who did know of Ramana Maharshi. And so, you know, after, I don't know, it wasn't immediately, but after, you know, a lot of the messages had been posted, friends started sending me things, you know, like a YouTube video of him. And one person bought me the book Timeless in Time. And, you know, through friends, I started to come to know Ramana Maharshi, the man. And the first experience I had of Ramana Maharshi was a YouTube video that I think Lisa Hansen sent to me. And, you know, they were talking about his teaching and showing black and white film strips of him. And I remember I just cried. I cried and cried and cried. And the reason I cried is because I knew myself in him. I had never, no, it's not true that I had never known myself. That's not true. I have known myself. I have had glimpses of myself throughout my life. But I denied and repressed them. Because of the I am bad thought. Because the I am bad thought would not let me admit to myself that I was the true self. And so whenever a glimmer of that would show up, I would repress it. And when I saw him, I cried because he didn't repress it. And I could see myself in him. So perfectly, so clearly. It was really just like looking in a mirror. And you know, and one of the things that I recognized in him that had always been true about me, but it was repressed, was knowing the difference between what's true and what's false. And so, you know, when Ramana Maharshi would teach that special powers do not matter at all, the only thing that matters is knowing who you are. It's like I've always known that, and I was too afraid to say it because everybody else thinks the special powers are so important, and my I am bad thought would cause me to repress what I knew, that none of that matters. It's unimportant, irrelevant. And really, you know, that's the answer that Nisargadatta is giving to this questioner. You know, it's unimportant. It's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with anything, whether I can sit here in India right now and tell you what the weather is in New York. That's missing the point entirely. And it's very hard to say that to people who believe in magical powers, that think these things are important. And to this day, I still occasionally just bite my tongue, because some of the people around me still want to believe these things are important. They still want to believe like it's important that physical healing happens. Right? They want to believe that especially. It's important. It's not important. It has no meaning whatsoever. It's a frame, it's a wisp. Whether that body is healthy or whether that body is not healthy is a frame, a wisp. Whether I have a special power that I can tell you what the weather's like in New York or whether I don't is a frame, it's a wisp. It's a part of the non-reality, it's a part of the script, it's a part of the movie, it's a part of the fourth principle of God. It has absolutely nothing to do with truth. Nothing. The questioner says, in asking the question about the weather in New York, where did I make the mistake? So that's good. Apparently, the questioner picked up maybe from Nisargadatta's attitude. Who knows? Nisargadatta may have been yelling all this stuff because, he had a tendency to do that. So he may have been screaming this answer in his face. How can I tell you? Such things need special training. You know how Nisargadatta was. I was like, okay, so where did I go wrong? He may have thrown the guy back a little bit. In asking the question about the weather in New York, where did I make the mistake? And Nisargadatta is about to give an answer that's very much the one I just gave. He says, the world and mind are states of being. The supreme is not a state. It pervades all states. But it is not a state of something else. It is entirely uncaused, independent, complete in itself, beyond time, space, mind, and matter. That, in effect, is what I just said, right? Everything, everything, everything in the fourth principle of God, everything in manifestation, whether it appears holy or special or not, is the same. It's a wisp, it's a frame, it's a temporary manifestation. It has absolutely nothing to do with truth. So the world and the mind are states of being, and the supreme again is beyond. So the questioner says, by what sign do you recognize it? I'm not quite sure what he means by that. Let's see what Nisargadatta says. Ah, okay, that's the point. It leaves no traces. He's still trying to turn the truth into an object. By what sign do you recognize it? Nisargadatta says, that's the point. It leaves no traces. There is nothing to recognize it by. It must be seen directly by giving up all search for signs and approaches. When all names and forms have been given up, the real is with you. You need not seek it. Some words I just can't say. Here's one of them. Plurality and diversity are the play of the mind only. Reality is one. The questioner says, if reality leaves no evidence, there is no speaking about it. Nisargadatta says, it is. And this is the second time, and in fact, in the next line is the third time in this message where the word is was italicized. I mentioned to you all a while ago that Michael Langford says that most of the words in the dictionary, point to illusion. I was once told by inner wisdom the only word in the English language that has any meaning at all is the word is. Is. That's the only word that has any meaning. All other words have no meaning. And that's what Nidad is just saying here. It is, and is italicized. It cannot be denied. It is deep and dark, mystery beyond mystery, but it is, while all merely happens. The questioner says, is it the unknown? Nisargadatta says, it is It is beyond both the known and unknown. But I would rather call it the known than the unknown. For whenever something is known, it is the real that is known. The questioner says, is silence an attribute of the real? Nisargadatta says, this too is of the mind. All states and conditions are of the mind. The questioner says, what is the place of samadhi? And Nisargadatta says, not making use of one's consciousness is samadhi. You just leave your mind alone. You want nothing, neither from your body nor from your mind. And I just read that quickly because we were near the end of the message and I wanted to finish it so I wouldn't be left with like just a few sentences. But basically what this last part of this conversation is saying is the same thing that we saw last night in the teaching from Rupert Spira and Ramana Maharshi about everything that is not present in deep sleep is not real. And what is present in deep sleep is real. So can you perceive that which is present in deep sleep? No. But would the word is still apply to that which is in deep sleep? Can you say deep sleep is? Can you see the peace that you really do not know as an object? You can't recall it with a memory, but the peace in deep sleep is? Can you say, even though you have no recollection whatsoever, that you is, that's bad English, but you is, your existence is, what you really are, is in deep sleep? So this is what Nisargadatta is trying to point to. It's beyond everything known, and yet somehow it's still known, because if you really contemplate it, you know you are in deep sleep. You know peace is in deep sleep. Although you have no recollection of it. All right, I'll release the mic and Ken in just a moment. I will give you a title.